Hi and welcome to SCL, the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. My name is Rob from robnanphoto.com and this is my little audio diary about my journey through the wonderful world of photography. Well, hi everybody. It's 9:30 on the evening of September 11th, 2011. So I guess first words go out to everybody who's been affected by the events of 9/11 and the subsequent things that happened afterwards as well. I know it's been a very somber day for lots of people in America and Britain and across the world, and so my thoughts are with you all as well. What I'd like to talk about today, though, is a couple of things, what I've been up to, and then I thought I'd go through some lighting jargon, just as much to help me understand and remember what lots of these things mean, as well as to share that with everybody else as well. As usual, what have I been doing this week? Well, you might remember last week I was talking about the Pentax Auto 110, which is the world's smallest SLR system with interchangeable lenses, and I've been taking a few photographs with that. The weather's been a bit grotty this week in the UK, been lots of rain and lots of grey skies, so I haven't had that many opportunities, but it's a nice little camera. I've got the 24mm f2.8 lens on there. I've just been taking the odd snap. So it'd be good to see, once I finish that roll of 110 film, pop it out. I think what I'm probably going to do is pop it out, stick the wide-angle lens on, shoot a 110 cartridge with the wide-angle lens, and then send them both off to a photo lab somewhere in England and have them developed and see how they come out. I'm quite looking forward to that. But what I've also done this evening, I've just finished developing a roll of film. I can't remember where I got it. I think I got it in a box of other stuff at a car boot a few months ago. A roll of Patterson film, Patterson of the developing tanks fame, a Patterson 800 speed black and white film. Expired, I think, in 1998, and I used it in a Olympus Mu 1, which is a slightly bigger version of the more famous Olympus Mu 2 Stylus Epic. And the Mu 1 is it's a 35mm compact camera with a fixed 35mm lens, and it's an f3.5 maximum aperture rather than 2.8 on the more sought after Stylus Epic. But it's a nice little camera. I just put the roll of film through it to see what it would do. And I tell you what, I just really enjoy developing film. I haven't developed a roll of film probably for a month or two. So I mixed up a fresh batch of developer, stop, and fixer. Got all my kit out, dusted it all off, washed it down, and spent half an hour just developing a roll of film. And it really is quite relaxing, I find, but also exciting at the same time. But you've got to be almost zen-like as you're doing it, because especially when you're developing old film or using a camera that you've not used before, you've got no idea whether the negatives are going to come out at all. So you don't want to get your hopes up too much, the fact that they've come out at all. You're kind of fully expecting to take that roll of film out at the end of the process and for it to be completely black or completely clear. So you kind of got to be a bit nonchalant about the final results and just enjoy the process of pouring the chemicals in, timing it, shaking the Patterson tank, inverting it, you know, once every minute. And again, I'd say if anybody fancies having a go at developing their own black and white film, just have a go. It's dead easy. I just have a little box, and in there I've got the Patterson tanks, I've got my chemicals, and I just dig them out when I've developed some film, and in about half an hour I've got a developed roll of 35mm, which I just hang up to dry overnight. And it means that I've got to pull my finger out and plug in the... Excuse me, I can't remember, was it an Epson printer I got a few weeks ago from the car boot sale? Might have been Epson, Canon, what am I talking about, printer? Scanner. So I've got to plug that in and scan those negatives. But that'll help me to spur me on, because the negatives have come out. They look like there's plenty of contrast in them. You know, when you look at the landscape shots, there's a sky and there's a ground and you can kind of see stuff. So that means I've got something out of them, so I need to scan them and then get up on the web so I can do a kind of mini review of the Stylus Epic 1, the Mu 1, and just kind of a little piece about using really, really expired film. And this, the problem normally we have with high-speed expired film, like this 800 stuff, is that it's a lot more prone to fogging. So if you imagine film anyway, if it's in a canister, you think, well, it's going to last forever, isn't it? Well, it's not, because X-rays and the electromagnetic waves that are bouncing around the universe will slowly affect the film and slowly develop it. A normal sort of slow-speed film, say 60, 100, 200, probably 400 as well, doesn't really get affected that much by that. But high-speed films like 800s and 1600s and 32s can as well. So I wasn't holding out that this Patterson 800 film would come out, but it looked like it has. So, yeah, I can't wait to scan it and see what I've come up with. But before we go on and talk about lighting jargon, a quick word from our sponsor, GoToMeeting.com. As you well know by now, if your company is into conference calls and you spend a fortune travelling across the country, travelling across the world to have meetings with peers at your company, maybe clients, sales pitches, that sort of thing, forget doing that. Just do it on GoToMeeting. Because GoToMeeting is a conference call done over your PC, whereby everybody who's in on the meeting can see what's on your PC, see what's on your desktop, they can see the agenda, they can see the photos, they can see the files, they can see the sales pitch, they can see the statistics, and everything becomes much more productive because people are actually concentrating and getting involved and they're not just sitting there reading the paper. But it's even better than that now, because GoToMeeting has HD Faces, which is video calling as part of the GoToMeeting package. So all you do is you send somebody an invite to a meeting, they go to GoToMeeting, they put in the code, and a couple of minutes later, they're in the meeting, beautiful high-definition video, when you can talk face-to-face with each other with voice over IP calling and video, and they can see what's on your desktop. What more could you want from a system like that? And you'll save money in terms of time, in terms of more effective meetings, and in terms of productivity for yourself, your colleagues, the people who work for you, and the people that you communicate across the business world. But you can try it for free. Just visit the URL gotomeeting.com, click on the try it free button, and enter the promo code podcast. So gotomeeting.com, click on the try it free button, and enter the promo code podcast. And I'm sure if your company uses conference calls now, after you've tried GoToMeeting, you won't be doing them again. You'll always be having GoToMeeting meetings. So, back to lighting jargon. After my brief foray into the world of off-camera flash, when I was lucky enough to have a Nissin DI622 flash for the last few weeks, it kind of got me into it. But one of the things is, when you're over on thestrobist.com or reading articles about lighting and flash, they tend to use terms that you don't always understand. I'm pretty au fait with things like f-stops and shutter speeds, depth of field and things like that. But when it comes to lighting, I'm not so sure. So I've done a bit of research, turning into Sean Connery, done a bit of research, and I'd just like to sort of share with you and some of these things that I've sort of discovered. So the first thing is the difference between the types of lighting you can use. You've got on-camera lighting and off-camera lighting, so that's pretty obvious. So you've got like the flash on your camera that pops up or is already there, and you can also put an extra flash on your camera, so that's on-camera flash, excuse me, or on-camera lighting. And then you have off-camera lighting, which can be lots and lots of other things. On-camera lighting also now doesn't have to be flash. It could also be a constant light source with the LED lights that you can buy now, which are really good for working on video. So, as we move into off-camera flash, because that's where it gets interesting, you have, first off, if you start with the old-fashioned stuff, so hot lights. So what's a hot light? Well, a hot light is a constant light source. So imagine back in the 1920s when Hollywood starlets and stars were having their photos taken, and they would have these big spotlights shining on them. That's a hot light. It's a light that's on all the time, shining on your subject. And the big advantage of hot light is that you can see in front of you pretty much what the photograph is going to turn out like, because the light is always there. The disadvantage is in the name. They get very, very hot, use lots of electricity, and they're not very portable. So that's when you move on to flashes. So a flash, again, is a light source that can just put out an incredible amount of light, but for a very, very short period of time, just like the on-camera flash on your camera. However, you get different types of flashes. You get a studio flash. Now, these are big things. These are big heads. And what these do is it's like the flash on your camera, but much, much bigger, and it'll run from the mains or run from a power pack. It normally sits on a stand, and it might have some sort of modifier in front of it, but more about modifiers in a minute. So that would be what we would call a studio flash. So it's a big thing, and it just sits there, and when you fire your camera, somehow that flash will fire. They might even have a modelling light on them as well. And what a modelling light is, it's an extra light on the studio light, on the studio flash, sorry, that will shine a constant light on your subject to give you a rough idea of where the shadows might fall. Again, the advantage of studio flashes is they're more portable than hot lights. They don't use as much electricity. They don't get hot. Well, they do if you keep firing them a lot. And they just give you that burst of high-intensity light, but they're quite big. And they're still called, people still might call them flashes or strobes. And then kind of the last type of flash we're interested in are the small flashes that are either on your camera, attached to your camera, or you can put them on stands. And these type of flashes or strobes, probably the best thing to call them is speed lights, because a speed light is only ever a small flash. A speed light is never a studio flash or a hot light. A speed light is what it is. You know, it's a SB900, it's a 430EX, that sort of thing. It's a flash that can go on top of your camera or can go on the stand. You can use it separately. The next things that they talk about is triggers for flashes. So how do you fire them? The first type is when the flash is on top of your camera, and then the flash is triggered by the electronics on the little shoe on the bottom. And that little shoe on the bottom is called a hot shoe, because the camera communicates to the flash through that shoe. Now, if you're using an old film camera, it may well have a cold shoe. And what that means is there's no communication through the shoe at all. What you have to do is you have to put the flash on your camera using the cold shoe, and then you have an extra wire, an extra lead that comes from the camera body and into the flash, and that will trigger it that way. Now, if the flash or the speed light isn't on your camera, you need to trigger it some other way, and there's lots of different ways of doing it. The first way you could probably say is just with a lead. So you run a lead, normally from the flash port on your camera, all the way to the flash, and then that will fire it. Or it could well be done wirelessly, so without a wire, and then that way maybe you do it optically. So as your camera flash fires, pop, there's a little sensor on the speed light that goes, "Oh, that flash has just fired, I will fire myself." And so they almost fire simultaneously, and that works very well. Or they could do it by infrared, or maybe they could do it as what are they called? Pocket Wizards. Is it Pocket Wizards? The famous brand. They do it via radio frequency, so they can travel long distances and they don't get much interference. So as you see, there's lots of ways of triggering flashes off camera. You also have auto flash and manual flash. Now, this is called lots of different names depending on which camera system you're using. And basically, it means if you're using some sort of auto flash system, like an ETTL system, something like that, or ITTL, what it means is the camera will judge how much flash needs to be done automatically. So when you press the button on your camera to take a picture, when you press the shutter release, the flash will normally fire twice. You won't see it twice, but it will fire twice. And with the first one, the camera will judge how much light, it will bounce the light off your subject, and it will come back, and the camera will go, I think we need a little bit more flash, and then it will adjust the flash power and make it brighter or lower. And then it will also judge the exposure for the background. So the camera balances the flash against the background, so you get a balanced exposure, and that's automatically. With manual type flash, when you put your flash to manual, or maybe it's on an off-camera situation where you have to use it manually, what you do is you control the power of the flash on the flash. You turn it up and you turn it down, normally in a fraction of a stop increments. Another term they'll use a lot is something called high-speed sync. Now, what that refers to is a problem you face whenever you're using a flash on a camera, well, most SLRs anyway. After a certain point, after a certain shutter speed, you can no longer use the flash, because you can actually see the shutters of your camera in the picture when the flash fires, and it's normally round about a 200th of a second and above. And when you go up to a 500th of a second, say, when your shutter works, it works very, very strangely, but it works on curtains zooming across the inside of your camera. So the shutter doesn't completely open and close like you'd expect it to. It actually runs a slit across the scene inside your camera. And what happens is when the flash fires, you see that hole, you see that slit. And this has always been a problem, because if you want to shoot outside during the day and you want to use your flash to light your subject, but you want to darken the background down, the way that you would normally do that is by using a very fast shutter speed. But you can't with flash because you're limited to, say, 200th of a second. Now, with high-speed sync, and some flashes and some cameras are capable of dealing with this, what happens is that it's just firing once, where you get to see the shutter curtain as it travels across the scene. The flash actually strobes and fires for, you know, I'd say 1,000 times, really, really fast, but for the whole sequence of that exposure. So if you're shooting at a 500th of a second, the flash will be firing for 500th of a second. It will strobe on and off, blah, 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 really fast. So you don't get to see the curtain. The downside of this, although it's a fantastic thing, you get a lot less power out of your flash, because it can't fire at full power that often. So high-speed sync is often used by people who want to freeze action or want to take really dramatic portraits outside by darkening the noonday sun with their shutter speed, and then using high-speed sync to light up their subject. You also then have the whole world of what we would call modifiers. And modifiers are normally things that you put in front of your light source to change it. And these could be umbrellas, which can either reflect light or you can shoot through them. It could be grids, it could be snoots, it could be softboxes, it could be beauty dishes, lots of different things. But that's a whole different kettle of fish, and I'm not going to go through all of them today. I'll just talk about a few of them. Now, what's kind of spurred me on to do this podcast and talk about the jargon that we use in lighting is the fact that I got to play with a flash, but also a fantastic guide by a photographer called John Flick, and I got this link off the Strobis Flickr group, and he's a professional photographer from Australia, I think he is anyway, and he's done this guide to studio lighting, and it's an ebook and it's free. It's fantastic, and I'm going to put the link in the show notes. And this is what I'm basing today's show all on. And if you're listening to the podcast now and you're by your computer, go to www.dragonimage.com.au. That's www.dragonimage.com.au. And it's /_manuals, M-A-N-U-A-L-S, /studio lighting setup ebook.pdf. So, you know, one long word, studio lighting setup ebook.pdf. And you should be able to download it. Again, if you're not at your computer, if you go to robnumphoto.com a little bit later on, probably over the next couple of days, I'll have the show notes up, and I'll have a link, and you can download this book for free. Save it on your computer and look at it, and it really is a fantastic guide. It goes into real detail. And one of the things I love about it, not only does he talk about the jargon and what you use at the beginning, but then he has setups, what he's actually done with professional shots from his portfolio. I said, look, this was a one light setup, this is how I did it, with three dimensional pictures, this is a two light setup, this is a four light setup, this is a five light setup. And then he talks about vision and artistry at the end as well. It's a fantastic ebook. I recommend anybody to have a look at it, even if you're not into lighting, to be honest. I'm not even thinking about it, because the images are good and it'll get you thinking about how you can move your subject into different places, say when you're out and about outside or by a window and things like that. Really is very, very good indeed. Okay, so the podcast dragging on up to 20 minutes now. Let's start off. So Rembrandt lighting. We've all heard about Rembrandt lighting, haven't we? People say, oh yes, that's a Rembrandt light. And you think, oh, what? Rembrandt, what, the painter? But this is a photograph. What are you talking about? But Rembrandt lighting is quite simply a style of lighting where, if you can imagine, for the purposes of this podcast, you're the photographer and you're standing in front of a model. So she's sitting on a stool in front of you with a black background behind her. Now, with Rembrandt lighting, what you do is you have a light source to your right and up a bit, shining down on her. so it's like diagonally coming down and forward onto her. And with Rembrandt lighting, what happens is you're creating a quite natural looking light because that's where the sun would be. But it also creates quite a lot of contrast in the face. And the trick to look for, and I've started doing this since I read this, if you want to see if something's got Rembrandt lighting, with our model who's in front of us and the light is above and to the right shining diagonally down on her, she's got a little triangle underneath her right eye. That's a little, it's a triangle formed by the shadow from her nose and her cheek. So, and you look at other photographs or paintings and look for that triangle. And if you see that triangle of exposed skin, of lit skin, that's probably the person who's tried to recreate, whether by purpose or by accident, Rembrandt lighting. And of course, do a quick search for Rembrandt, have a look at his paintings and you'll see exactly what you're coming up. It's really, really nice and flattering. So that's Rembrandt lighting. So camera up and to the right or left, shining down, and you can look for this little triangle. Now, split portrait lighting is normally done for dramatic effect, and it's where the light is to one side. So the light's shining in on our model, but the light is, say, by her left shoulder to our right, shining straight across her. So if you can imagine the left side of her face is nicely exposed and lit up, and the other side is in complete darkness with lots of shadow, loads of contrast, looks very, very good. Now, also remember, with all these sort of effects and these points, John explains this in his guide, is all these looks can be altered by using things like reflectors. So what you would do is you could have the light coming in from one side, then you would have a reflector to reflect some of the light back in to soften the effect. The next style, butterfly. You must have heard of this butterfly portrait lighting. When I heard that, I was like, what? Butterfly? What does that mean? Well, with butterfly, what you tend to do is you'd have the light fairly close to your model, but above on the top and slightly in front of her or him, shining down. So it's illuminating her forehead, her cheeks, her nose, and it's really quite flattering, and it emphasises the features. And apparently the reason why it's called butterfly is because the shape of the shadow underneath the nose can look like a butterfly. Again, I'm relying completely on John's word on this, so there we go. Clamshell portrait lighting. Now, this is a method where, imagine we've got the model in front of us on the stool with a black background. We're sort of maybe, I don't know, 5 feet away, we've got a camera and a tripod. And in between us and the subject, there's two light sources, one above, shining down on her, sort of at an angle, so it's like halfway between us, and another one below, about halfway between us, shining up, both at, say, 45 degrees. So they're lighting from the top and lighting it from the bottom. And that produces a look that is, again, great for beauty and fashion photography because it gets rid of all the lines and creases in anybody's face. It's very, very flattering. And the trick, though, is both these lights are of the same output, and so you get this really pleasing effect. Very similar to a type of flash that I didn't talk about before, which was a ring light. And a ring light is a flash that goes around the lens of your camera. Used to be used in medical and macro photography all the time. And with a ring light, you get a very determined type of flash that smooths skin tones out. It's very popular and flashy. If you look at someone like Rankin and his fashion photography work, lots of it is done with a big ring flash. It's an interesting look. Now, the next couple of things are really just ways of helping to bring your subject out from a background. The first one would be hair light. So this is where you put a light source behind your subject and off to one side and above, just shining down on their hair. And what this means, it helps to lift them from the background, stops them from merging in. And the other one would be one that's called a rim light. So the rim light is a light that would be placed normally behind and above your subject, shining on them. So it's like their silhouette is softened and lit up by this light as well. Four, so there we go. So hopefully, just by going through some of those, I've kind of got rid of some of the fear about the different jargon that you have in lighting, and maybe even whetted your appetite to go over somewhere like thestrobist.com and have a look at the different work that they do over there, and where he explains how he does light setups. And again, for me, I mean, I don't have a big lighting kit, but I must admit, I was looking on eBay, and you can pick up very nice home studio kits for very little money indeed. I was looking at one today, which was a three-head kit with three studio flashes that had optical slaves in them as well, or you could wire them in. It had all the stands for them. It had barn doors for them, loads of different gels, which are coloured plastic to balance the light source. So, say you wanted to balance a flash to make it look like it was daylight, you could put an orange flash on it if it was light in the day, that sort of stuff. And it was something silly, like £120. I thought, gosh, that's less than the price of one speed light. So I'm thinking about maybe doing something like that, maybe getting something like that for Christmas. Or the other way I'm going to do it is I'm looking for, and if anybody's found any of these, tell me, an optical slave system. So optical slave triggers, but they work with digital, so don't fire on the first flash. You can buy the ones on eBay and all over the place, which are like little cubes with a little round plastic clear bit on that you put on the bottom of a flash. And what happens is when your flash fires, that will flash the other fire. But the problem with those is that they don't work with digital flashes that have pre-flash, because the first flash sets off the flash, so the slave flash goes off too quick. But if anybody knows of different ones, tell me, because the advantage of using that is that if you could buy, you can buy sort of three or four of those for like $20 or something, get a load of second-hand cheap flashes, you know, from the car boot sale or whatever, and then you can base your lighting setup on that. So there we go, that's enough talking about studio lighting and flash lighting for 1 week. I hope I haven't bored everybody to death. I know it's been fairly interesting and people are sort of starting to think about how they could apply that to their photography as well. All that remains is the thanks to everybody. Thanks everybody for taking part in this month's photo assignment. There's already photos in there, and I haven't even posted anything yet, and it's the 11th. And remember, the assignment this week is my hometown, so any photograph that's related to that at all, get over to the Flickr group, robinandphoto.com Flickr group, and post your images in the thread there. Again, I'll put the link in the show notes. So if you're not quite sure, just visit robinandphoto.com. That's robinandphoto.com. And you can click on the link and that will take you over there. Remember, joining Flickr is completely free. So, that's it for this week. Thanks everybody for downloading and listening to the podcast. And hopefully, pretty soon, I'll see you on Flickr.